The Lions beat the Giants 24-10. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Tuesday, September the 19th. Should be partly sunny day today, warm, 40% chance of some morning rain, and a high today of 76. Tonight, partly cloudy and mild, low of 62. Tomorrow's a bit of a surprise, partly sunny and hot, 86 degrees tomorrow afternoon. How about that? Wind is calm. Pretty good cloud cover this morning, 65 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, an intriguing look at how human beings have viewed the future. In part two, we'll be catching up with Steve Rogstad and finding out about this weekend's tour of historic places. Stay with us. The next few minutes are going to be spent confronting one of the most vexing of human mysteries. What is time? And what does it mean to travel through time? Is it possible to travel into the future? Is it possible to travel back? And what does it mean for us as human beings? And how have human beings, through our own history, viewed and understood time? Those big questions and more beyond them are explored in a really fascinating book called Time Travel, A History. And the author, James Glick, has been part of the morning show before. I interviewed James Glick about a previous book called The Information, which did a beautiful job of exploring the way in which human beings have accumulated and transmitted and encountered information down through the centuries. He is also the author of Chaos, Making a New Science, Genius, The Life and Science of Richard Feynman, and the aforementioned book that I just said, The Information. This book, again, is called Time Travel, A History. James Glick, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be back with you, Greg.
I wonder, what is it like to confront questions like time itself, how we measure, discuss, and understand time, and how we have done that over the millennia? I can't imagine how sort of immersive an experience it must be to confront questions like that.
Yeah, I have trouble imagining it, too. Time, of course, had popped. I've been writing about science for a long time, so some of the scientists I've written about have explored questions of time, and I've always been fascinated, but I never in a million years would have dreamed of writing a book just about time. I think that would have been too scary. So instead, I thought I was tackling a much smaller topic, just the subject of time travel, which, you know, what could be more fun than that? I'm not particularly a science fiction aficionado. I don't know if you are, but But I always enjoyed time travel stories and time travel movies, and there's something about that genre that makes your mind bend a little bit. So I liked that aspect of it, too. But it did turn out, as I wrote, a history of time travel, which is a kind of short history because it's a new idea, only a little more than a century old, that I couldn't avoid writing about time itself and trying to understand what it actually is.
Right. And, of course, one of the reasons why we do not see stories of time travel centuries ago is because, as you tell us, human beings, at least by and large, did not seem very much preoccupied with the passage of time, or certainly didn't seem to write about it in the way that it is written about and thought about now. In fact, say a word about this notion of the turn of the century and what a recent development it is for us to even bother to notice something like that.
Well, of course, everybody knew about time and speculated about it and wondered about it occasionally. But one thing I've learned is that our human notions of time have gotten much more complicated, especially in the last century. But beginning maybe in the 19th century, after the Industrial Revolution had begun to work its changes on England and Europe, and people were starting to think about the future in a new way. People didn't have a notion until then of the future as a place that might be really different, that might have all kinds of wonders, and that's because the world just wasn't changing that fast. So the turn of the 19th century, the year 1900, was a really exciting event. If you look at old newspaper headlines, you see people celebrating and throwing parties and stringing these new electric lights across the street and in front of City Hall and wondering about, maybe they're going to be flying cars or electric cars or underwater boats or all kinds of new electrical marvels. You know, the telephone was brand new. The electric light was still new. So there was excitement, and it was a big round number, and there was a lot of speculation about what the year 2000 would bring. But if you look 100 years earlier, at the turn of the previous century, nobody celebrated the year 1800, and nobody in the year 1800 was thinking about how marvelous the year 1900 would be.
Another way in which you illustrate this for us, first of all, speaking of history, you mentioned that the first mention we have of a centennial celebration of any great significance was our own American centennial in 1876, and ahead of that, people just didn't bother celebrating the 100th anniversary of much of anything. But I think you make the point even in even more interesting way when you talk about something that has been around for nearly as long as there have been human beings, the idea of prophecy, of fortune telling, of foreseeing the future. You really draw an interesting contrast in terms of the kind of questions that a fortune teller, even let's say a thousand years ago, would have been asked and would have felt like they could answer versus the kind of questions that would never occur to such a person to even think about.
Right. That's an important distinction. It's not that people didn't know that there was a future of some kind, and people always, as you say, they went to fortune tellers and they read tea leaves and they wanted to know about their own future. Maybe their children. Is there going to be a tall, dark, handsome stranger in my future? But they didn't think about the future the way we do now, as a foreign country, as a place that where people are going to speak a different language and have all kinds of equipment that we don't have, or actually, as we tend to think about it in our time, as a place that might be terrible or broken or dystopian.
It would be the same world, essentially. I mean, once upon a time, that's all people could conceive. And now, of course, we conceive of a future that might be drastically different from what we see now in great ways or perhaps in terrible ways.
Right. So for young H.G. Wells, writing in England in 1895, trying to write his first book, he was interested in setting a fantastic story in an imagined future. And he had the problem of, how do you get there? He couldn't just announce to the reader, okay, now we're going to be in the year 8000. He had to invent a machine, which he called the time machine. And that was the first time anybody did that.
Mm.
So now suddenly everybody's off and running and thinking about time travel as a thing they could write about or invent or explore.
Right. Explain how a certain brand new technology was of such direct inspiration to H.G. Wells in writing The Time Machine, a technology that most of us would not immediately think of as of having any direct relevance to the notion of time travel.
Well, I wonder if you're thinking about his bicycle, because The Time Machine is, when you look at Wells's description, a sort of fancy bicycle. And he had a bicycle that he loved pedaling up and down the River Thames, and on the other hand, in 1895 he'd never seen a motor car. Mm. But when you talk about technology, you could also be talking about railroad trains and the electric telegraph, because these were technologies that were beginning to change the landscape in England, where Wells was born, and across the rest of the world too, and enabling new forms of instantaneous communication and allowing human beings to synchronize their clocks and making it necessary for human beings to create time zones. And all of these things were expanding our minds, as it were, opening us up to new possibilities and giving us new kinds of headaches.
Right. One of the things you say about our modern world is that essentially we all operate under a misassumption that there is such a thing as perfect synchronicity, and that a lot of the technologies that we use on a daily basis, on a momentary basis pretty much all day long, we assume exist with this perfect synchronicity of time, and you suggest that it's in a sense maybe a bit naive for us to think about time in such cut and dried fashion.
Yeah, we're learning to deal with certain paradoxes about time. I mean, we sort of know that Albert Einstein taught us that synchronicity, perfect synchronicity, is impossible, that time is relative, that when you travel near the speed of light, your clock is running more slowly than the clock of your twin brother who you left behind on Earth. And so those clocks get out of sync. But on the other hand, we do live in a world where more than ever we rely on perfectly synchronized time signals from atomic clocks at the Directorate of Time in Washington and in Paris. And, I'm old enough to remember having that when my wristwatch would always run a few minutes slow or a few minutes fast, and if I needed to reset it, I would dial a number on the telephone and listen to somebody tell me what time it is. And now we rely on a very synchronized electronic network to tell us what time it is. So that's a paradox. Synchronicity is an illusion, and synchronicity is essential to modern life. And meanwhile, our notion of time is more complicated than that, because we also know that time passes more quickly if we're doing something that's enjoyable, and passes more slowly if we're bored, and passes more quickly when we're old than when we're young, when a month seems like it's going to be an eternity. And so these also are forms of psychological relativism.
Right, of course. And of course, you spend plenty of time in your book talking about the various metaphors we utilize for thinking about time. That is time some kind of a stream? Is time like a river that flows, and does it flow in one direction? And other metaphors that are certainly imperfect in helping us understand time. I want to finish by talking about the chapter of your book which is called Buried Time. in which, in a sense, we're not talking about time travel at all in the sense that H.G. Wells and other science fiction writers conceive it, but this notion, in a sense, of trying to stop time by filling a capsule with various objects and so on. I think this is the kind of thing that's relatively quaint and maybe not even quite as common as it used to be, but I think you explore this in such fascinating fashion. As you considered this so carefully, what did you come away with in terms of the most important observations about this notion of the time capsule and freezing time somehow?
Oh, I'm glad you like that chapter, because it's a bit of an oddball digression. And you're right, it does, the idea of time capsules does start to feel a little bit quaint. It's something that there was a big vogue for in the middle of the 20th century and around the big World's Fair in New York, where suddenly people thought, let's send a message about ourselves to the future. Let's bury a part of our civilization and announce that they should dig it up in the year 6241. And won't they be excited to learn about our nylon stockings and listen to the voice of Winston Churchill recorded on, you know, on a dictaphone or something? And now we're beginning to discover that even though people do still bury time capsules, most of the stuff that gets buried just stays buried and is forgotten. And time capsules are a sort of weird, crippled time machine that we bury in the earth, and it advances forward into the future at the very slow rate of one day per day.
Yes, you call it at one point an effort in enacting reverse archaeology and reverse nostalgia, and it really is intriguing to think about the way in which this and other matters of science and literature can help us think anew about this thing called time. Your book, again, is called Time Travel, A History. It includes not only extensive commentary on the great classic of H.G. Wells, but other works of literature, including some of the earliest efforts of science fiction, who have also tackled this very intriguing notion. And lots of good science in the book as well. It's published by Vintage Books, a division of Penguin, the author James Glick. James Glick, thank you for creating yet another fascinating book. I'm glad we had the chance to speak about it today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Craig.
We're coming up on 8:29 here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. This is the Tuesday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm absolutely delighted to be catching up today with Steve Rogstad, who has been on the morning show any number of times, although I'm shamefaced to hear that it has not happened since 2009, at least as far as we know, back in 2009, which was the 200th birthday of Abraham Lincoln's birthday. We did all kinds of special morning shows about Abraham Lincoln. I aired all kinds of author interviews, and I made a point on Lincoln's birthday to have Steve Rogstad in the studio, a remarkable intellect and a dogged and faithful devotee to our 16th president. And of course, any number of times before that, Steve Zragstad was on our program to talk about Abraham Lincoln. We are talking about history today, not at least very specifically about Abraham Lincoln, but rather about an event that many people in southeastern Wisconsin look forward to year after year, the annual tour of historic places under the auspices of Preservation Racine. And Steve Rogstad happens to be the chair of this year's tour, which is the 42nd annual tour of historic places. And there are a couple of ways in which this year's tour is a little bit different, a little bit out of the ordinary compared to the more typical tour of historic places. So I'm glad we have a few minutes to be able to speak about this this year's event, which is coming up this Sunday, September 24th, from 11:30 until 5:30. And Steve Rogstad, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. I'm really, really pleased to be here today.
It's good to see you in that chair again, and we won't let another, 8 years go by before we have you back again. But I'm so glad that we can talk about this this terrific event. Ahead of us talking about this specific tour, I wonder if you could say a word about the organization under which this tour is presented, Preservation Racine. Tell us what you know about this organization and about its central mission.
Well, I've been involved in Preservation Racine for many years. I've been on the board. I've served as president. I've worked in some various roles associated with this tour in the past. This year, I'm doing the tour chair role. But Preservation Racine has been around since 1973, and it has a couple of missions. One is historic preservation. So we are concerned with the preservation of buildings, artifacts, neighborhoods. Can be a residence, could be a public building, in terms of we're very cognizant of trying to preserve to the best of our ability some of these historic buildings that might be slated for demolition. We're not in the business of preventing demolition, but we certainly want to make sure we are preserving the histories of buildings. That's the primary mission. So the Racine Heritage Museum has its mission, which has artifacts and exhibits. We do not do that, but we are primarily concerned with the preservation of the histories of these buildings, promoting the histories of them, educating the public about them. And to that end, we have been involved in some things. All of the fences around Mound Cemetery, for example, are attached to Preservation Racine. We actually put up a gravestone to Eugene Leach, the county historian, who became somewhat lost to history until we preserved his headstone and put one up. And we put on a century buildings event in May to always acknowledge about 12 buildings that turn 100 years old. And we have the homeowners there, and they're thrilled to death to get that acknowledgement. And then we do this tour of historic places, which we have been doing for 42 years this year.
Wow. Is it enough for a building to be old, I mean significantly old, for it to warrant the attention of and the protection of Preservation Racine? I mean, are all old structures to some extent worth preserving?
Well, one could make that argument that, that once you start losing historic buildings, for example, we lost the Rialto Theater in 1978, and the entire city was very upset over one of the wonderful theaters being, you know, demolished. Again, you know, Preservation Racine does not have the financial capability of just simply preserving every old building. However, if it does have significant history, and if it indeed is going to have to be demolished rather than restored or preserved, at least before it is no longer physically there, we can go in, record it for posterity, and get that those wonderful stories associated with that building. So, you know, I would argue, yes, is every building worth keeping? Probably not. Some of them are in such rough shape, and they no longer serve the purpose for which they were constructed. But many times we at least can preserve the history.
Right. And that's an important distinction that probably not all organizations maybe keep in mind. It seems like a wise way to approach what can be a really, really tricky matter. So when it came to putting together this year's tour, the 42nd annual tour, You as chair apparently were given a fairly free hand, it sounds like, in terms of how to put this together. And it sounds like you wanted to try to put something together that would be maybe a little bit out of the ordinary compared to the typical tour.
One of the, I think the thing that really compelled us this year to look at what we know as Mannery Park Subdivision is the fact that about almost 5 years ago now, well, I'll take that back, 3 years ago now, the Wisconsin State Historical Society was able to give a portion of Mannery Park and some recognition, and it was made a historic district for the city of Racine. Very often we think of history as something that's always 19th century. We have these old buildings in downtown Racine and then beautiful old buildings, but we have focused, I would say, primarily on older buildings that probably date back to around the turn of the century. Hmm. And they're very beautiful buildings. It's hard for us sometimes to imagine that Mannery Park, which was developed starting in 1929, will soon be 100 years old. I think if you poll the people that live in that area, they say, well, this is a modern neighborhood. Until you look at, well, when was your house built? Well, this one was built in 1936. Well, in 1936, in 2036, they're going to be 100 years old, the ones that were built in the late 20s. You know, we're only 12 years away from that point. So all of a sudden, what we used to think of as modern subdivisions are now becoming part of historic subdivisions.
Right. Isn't that something?
And it's hard for us, especially if we've lived through some of that development.
Right.
It's very difficult to believe that sometimes they're very old subdivisions. I remember renovating the Lincoln statue on State Street in 1998 and saying to the press at that time, I said, well, you know, in another 80 years, maybe it'll need to be refinished again, and maybe I'll have to go through this a second time. The problem is, you know, I'm significantly away from 1998,
right.
And I'm thinking, geez, that doesn't seem like that long ago. And I'm sure it's the same way for these homeowners.
Of course.
But Mannery Park has a rich history. It's going to turn 100 fairly soon and has some beautiful homes, wonderful architectural styles. And now it's a historic district.
Explain to even a few of our Racine listeners, but also especially to our, for instance, Kenosha listeners and listeners from other places, exactly what neighborhood we are talking about, and also the way in which you're taking some slight liberties in terms of exactly what you're thinking of as Mannery Park.
Well, we're looking at the area. If you're familiar with Racine, you're on Washington Avenue. And Mannery Park, the greater Mannery Park neighborhood, as I like to call it, is bordered Washington Avenue on the south, Lathrop Avenue on the east, Ohio Street on the west, and Graceland Boulevard or Haven on the north. So you've got this greater area. Mannery Park itself is legalistically pretty much Orchard Street, and not all of Orchard Street. But that whole area in the collective memory of Racine that I said has always been called Mannery Park. And so for that purpose and for the idea that we have other homes outside of the historic district, I wanted to have those to feel like they were included in the greater Mannery Park neighborhood. So that's the boundaries that I'm using for the tour. And we have five homes on this tour that are in the Mannery Park neighborhood. We have a fire station at Lathrop and Washington that was built right in the heart of the Depression, as these other homes were, by WPA workers. And that's going to also be on the tour, so you can see one of these original city buildings that was right there also in the heat of the development. And then we have one of the original farmhouses that accounted for all the agricultural land on which Mannery Park rests. And then we have Mount Cemetery on it this year, and I've taken some liberties of bringing in some wonderful stories, things that the public has probably never heard associated with Mount Cemetery. And then we have another building down by Taylor and Washington, which is the former Our Savior's Lutheran Church, which has been attached to what has become known as the Murray Mansion. That's also on the tour. So we have two older homes, five Mannery Park homes, a fire station, and we have Mount Cemetery. It's going to be a fantastic day.
No kidding. for the homes that are on the tour, and these are homes where people live right now. I mean, these aren't museums; these are people's homes. Is it a matter of picking up the phone and calling them or sending them an email? I mean, how does one even word such an entreaty or invitation for them to place their homes as part of this historic tour?
Well, I knock on the door, and. And other tour chairs, I'm sure, have knocked on doors. I started putting this tour together in some respects back in February. So it's about 10 months of work for a six-hour event. And your tour, you don't have a tour unless private citizens are willing to open up their homes and have the general public walk through them.
Right.
Without that concept, you have no tour.
Right. So in the case, for instance, of these five homes, were these five complete strangers on whose doors you were knocking?
Yes.
Wow.
And I think it's pretty much that way every year for all the tour chairs. It's, you have to convince them that, you know, one, their house has significance. Sometimes they don't even realize that. Sometimes they don't know the significance of the neighborhood that they live in. They might not be aware that they're in a historic district. You know, it's just where they live.
Hmm.
And you then not only have to obtain permission for them to go through public to go through the homes, but then we have a team of researchers that research these homes. And then based on that research, we write prepared scripts that are read the day of the tour, which is all based on solid research. And then we have to find, at least this year, 177 volunteers to man these homes on all these shifts and read these scripts. So it is a very detailed, choreographed event, and it requires a lot of great, talented people. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, we have them.
Mm-hmm. By the way, when you have a given home that is of some kind of historic interest, is it ever the case where you are permitted entry and you walk in and you realize that the inside of the home has been completely transformed in a way that might be regrettable from at least a historic point of view, might be perfectly lovely to look at and maybe more convenient for those living there, but in a sense, the inside of the home does not reflect its full rich history. Is that ever a case in which the historic interest of a home is so diminished that maybe it doesn't belong on the tour? Or in most cases, and in these cases, are we talking about homes that inside and out are still of great historic interest and beauty?
You know, Greg, no. I would say we do have tour homes on the tour whose owners, through the succession of owners, have changed entranceways, walls, have closed up walls, made new doorways. And it could be a rather modern-looking home compared to, let's say, in this case, 1936, to use that as a mean year this year. What's fascinating about it is very often we're able to find photographs of the home as it did look when it was constructed.
Wow.
And very often the owners will have received photographs from prior owners, or we are able to get in touch with prior owners who share photographs of when they lived there. And very often what we can do is sometimes we'll even have the original architectural plans that they're still in existence.
Hmm.
So the day of the tour, if we have architectural plans, we can put those out on a table. For those that might be architects that are coming through and looking at these homes, they're able to look and think, oh, look at the changes. We also put vintage photographs around so people can come in and contrast how this home looked and how it looked now. And sometimes you will hear people say things like, I never would have thought that you could make an older home like this so contemporary and make it very user-friendly for a modern family. So you see possibilities, but you still see history.
Hmm.
And I think that's the exciting part, that these people are not living in time capsules. These people are living in vibrant, functional homes. And the architecture can still be the same, the walls can be the same, but the decorating is different. And, you know, what a wonderful thing, because they have made that. And again, instead of the house deteriorating, They right. have invested in this home and made it very workable for them.
Sure, fully viable.
Right.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Steve Rogstad, who is the chair of this year's 42nd annual Tour of Historic Places under the auspices of Preservation Racine. And this year, in contrast to the focus that this tour often has, the tour this year is of Manry Park and includes an intriguing mix of private homes and a couple of other structures and Mound Cemetery. Should be a very, very interesting tour in a lot of different respects. Steve, you were saying that that this part of Racine once upon a time was heavily agricultural, and that there are still ways in which one can have a sense of that, even if the place now bears no immediately visible signs of having ever been a place in which agriculture was practiced. What are some of the ways in which this legacy still lives on?
Well, it was. You have to remember that Manry Park at this time would have, one, been in Mount Pleasant. It was not in the city of Racine. Two, it was all farmland and apple orchards. And so when you see streets named Orchard Street, Russet Street, that's all connected with the early agricultural part of the Reed family, which lived at the east end of Manry Park. There were two farms, the Reeds, and then we also had the Walkers at the west end. Both of these farming families had very, very prosperous farms. Some of them owned as many as 200 acres. And when you look at Manry Park, it developed just like the nation developed. We get into a period right around World War I where industrialization really took off in Racine. And as a result, the companies and the industries that were making technologies to help agriculturing families transformed themselves into making materials for the war effort. And so we have an industrial boom happening in Racine. And we could not, if you can imagine, get enough workers to come to Racine to meet the demand for industry. And at the same time, we had, you know, the farming industry had changed. Dairy prices had fallen. But in the 1920s, we were second in industry only to Milwaukee in the state of Wisconsin. I mean, our industry was phenomenal. And more workers were coming. And as a result, the dairy prices and some of the agricultural prices fell. So farms like that were owned by like the Reeds and the Walkers had thought, well, here's another way for us to still remain vibrant. They started platting subdivisions on their land. So the Reed family, for example, starting in 1925, started using a company, I think it was A.O. Mann Company. And so when you see Manry Park, it's a combination of the firm that designed it, Mann, and Ree, after the Reed family. And the going theory is both names were connected to form Manry Park. And they formed like what they called Manry Park Number 1, which was maybe a block or two of homes that were platted. And then eventually they added Manry Park Number 2 and Manry Park Number 3 as they went westward. The Walkers on the far end to the west, down by what is today like Washington and Indiana and Oregon, saw that and thought, well, this is a great thing. So they hopped on the bandwagon. Their farm down on that end was known as Hillcrest Farms. And they started platting their land. And so between 1929 and 1945, there wasn't one year that houses were not built in Manry Park. And Manry Park was still being developed in the 1960s. So you're talking about, you know, almost at least 35 years easily of development that was going on there. And, you know, about 5 years into the development is when the WPA workers, because we were in the heart of the Great Depression at that time. And what I find fascinating about this is these homes that you'll see, these beautiful brick homes with all these different styles of architecture, they weren't built in an affluent economic time. They were all built in the heart of the Depression. And the WPA workers, which were being used all over the country, which Franklin Delano Roosevelt brought into creation, built the fire station number 7, which is at Washington and Lathrop. So they had some presence at that end so they wouldn't have to wait in case there were fire emergencies. And they had a fire station right there to respond to this subdivision because we were growing westward. So the title that I gave the tour this year was Expanding Westward, Looking Upward. And that's exactly what we were doing. We were expanding westward, and in the heart of the Depression, when things were so bleak, we were looking upward, and we were still building and still expanding. And the stories that are contained in these homes, we have some wonderful homes. And I'll just tell you, we have one house that is currently the residence for former Senator John Lehman and his wife. They've put their house on the tour this year. And another house was the original house for the Curtin family. You might remember Curtin Medical Group on Northwestern Avenue.
Right.
Their house is on the tour this year. So some of the Curtin family are coming back the day of the tour to walk through their old home. You know, it's stories like that when you take a look at who are living in them now, and they're saying we're more than willing to open up our homes. And you know, that's very gracious. But the whole Mannery Park area is it's in its embryonic form was all farmland, which is very, very hard sometimes to imagine. But when you're at the Walker home, one of the two original farm homes that is on the tour this year, when you're standing on the grounds looking at that house, and you just kind of look around you because it's somewhat isolated and it's still rather, it's isolated. It has its own lawn and trees. You know, you're kind of set back quite a bit from Washington Avenue. Very easy to look around and think, yeah, this is the way it was in 1868 when this house was built by the Walker family.
Right, and of course that's a really good example of a beautiful home that, in our busy lives, we tend to breeze right past and not really take sufficient time to just sort of bask in its beauty and appreciate what kind of a home this represents.
Well, and we have two of them. We have the Walker home, which is phenomenal. You know, you go down Washington Avenue, and I can tell you most people have seen this house. But how often do you stop and think, well, why is there a house that looks from 1868 sitting in the middle of this urbanized area?
Right.
You
know?
Well,
right.
They're going to find out on Sunday. And the other home that we have that I'm very proud of that's included is on the East End by Taylor and Washington, the former Our Savior's Lutheran Church, which is attached to what has become known as the Murray Mansion, but it's called the George and Mary Murray House. And at the time it was built in 1874, it was built, if you could imagine, at $30,000. It was one of the most expensive and largest Italianate homes in the state of Wisconsin. When it was opened, he had large herds. He made his money not through real estate. He made it through farming and having large herds. And when his house was open, they actually threw a rather lavish party, and people from around the state came, including reporters for farming magazines and the newspapers, and reported when they went through it, they said it's the absolute pride of the area, you can imagine. But at the time when it was built, it was probably one, if not the largest, Italianate house in Wisconsin.
Wow. And you were mentioning, and I think some of our Racine listeners will know that this has been bought and turned into a sort of a catering center and hall for banquets and so on.
Absolutely.
And it'll be a fun chance for people to sort of step inside the door and see what has been done. You say they've poured a great deal of money into this place.
They've been working on this home for over a year and a half. It just opened this last May. They were very, very excited about being on the tour this year. They are a very well-known and distinguished caterer in Kenosha. This is them having a Racine presence now. And they have not only completely refurbished the mansion, which they're going to use for meeting rooms and various events such as weddings. There's going to be a bed and breakfast at the far end that people are going to be able to use. And then you have the entirely renovated former Our Savior's Lutheran Church, which is their large hall, which is just impeccably beautiful. And, you know, they have done this the right way in preserving a beautiful building, and they're just excited to be on the tour. And, you know, one of the great things is for if people put their homes on the tour, all of the research that is done on their building, when the tour is over with, they get a copy of all the research and everything, and which is exciting for them because they're finding out all of these facts and families that have, you know, gone through them and lived in them, and all of the Christmases and all of these family histories that are just it's exciting to read. But you see the people's faces when they're on the tour and they're hearing these scripts and they're hearing these stories and they're looking around and, oh, look at that. And, oh, I used to remember having arches, you know, like this in the house I grew up in. And people really do get excited about it.
That's terrific. So we're talking about the 42nd Annual Tour of Historic Places by Preservation Racine coming up this Sunday. So for someone who has never been on the Tour of Historic Places before, explain sort of the logistics of how it works.
Well, first, I would encourage you to get your ticket early. You can still buy advance tickets by going to www.preservationracine.org, and you can get an advance ticket there for $15. Now, if for some reason you decide to go the day of the tour, there's going to be three ticket places where you can pick up tickets. One's going to be at the Murray Mansion at Taylor and Washington. One, the other site is going to be at Mound Cemetery, and a third site will be the Walker Home, which is right by Washington and Indiana. Those three areas, you can pick up your tickets the day of for $18. You'll be given a tour booklet, which has a description of all the homes and the addresses, and you'll also have a wristband that shows that you're part of the tour. And the tour is yours at that point to do however you want to do it. There's no order for these nine public places for you to go through. You can do them in whatever order you want. And the tour is yours to do as you want to. You can do it leisurely. You have 6 hours to do nine sites. And I can tell you, you know, we range anywhere from 500 to 700 tour goers a year. And so, you know, I would encourage anybody to see the tour this year because it's so different from anything that we've done. But the homes we have are spectacular, and there's, you know, there's Tudor style homes, Tudor revival style homes, all sorts of different styles, and some, you know, you're going to find the modern ones of brick. There's one that I was in yesterday for a dry run of the tour, and the bathroom itself on this is phenomenal. You'll never see another bathroom like you'll see in this house, and people just walk in, and even the people that are working as volunteers, they go, oh, my gosh, look at that. Isn't that gorgeous? And it doesn't even look like it was put in 1936. It's original.
Oh, how fun. How wonderful. Well, there are all kinds of things to check out and to enjoy and explore. And, of course, a marvelous way to immerse oneself in the history of the fascinating city of Racine. Again, this is the 42nd Annual Tour of Historic Places for Preservation Racine, this year focused on the Manry Park neighborhood. Give the web address once again for the website for Preservation Racine.
www.preservationracine.org.
Very good. Steve Rogstad, the chair of this year's Tour of Historic Places. Steve, it's fantastic to catch up with you, and I can't imagine this event being in more capable and loving hands than yours, and we hope a lot of people will be coming out on Sunday. It looks like it's going to be gorgeous, gorgeous weather, and we hope a lot of people will take advantage of this opportunity to enjoy the Tour of Historic Places.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to your audience about it, and I look forward to seeing them all there.
Very good. Thanks again for being here. It's 8:58 here on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to speaking with Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor at Carthage College, Director of the Clawson Center. Professor Sear joins us once a month to offer his analysis of various current events and various topics of concern and interest. So that will be tomorrow's morning show. We have lots to talk about. on Thursday, among other things. I look forward to speaking with three representatives of the Kenosha Writers Guild. And this group has just published a brand new collection that represents the work of a number of their writers. I believe the publication is titled Undertow, and we will be speaking with some of them on Thursday's morning show. We'll be doing a couple of different things on Friday, including, I hope, previewing the comedy that currently graces the stage of the Racine Theater Guild, a hilarious comedy called Boying Boying that's going to be on Friday. So the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. And if you ever miss an interesting interview or want to hear one again, you